This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Maine Goodman, thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio and Veterans for Peace Chapter 72 are proud to co-sponsor a special presentation on Thursday, August 1st at 6:30 p.m. An insider's account of Guantanamo will examine the illegality, immorality, and inhumanity of the U.S. Naval Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, with Stephen T. Wax, Chief Federal Public Defender for the District of Oregon, Laura Sandown, a U.S. Navy veteran who served at Guantanamo, and S. Brian Wilson, a longtime peace activist, among others. An insider's account of Guantanamo will take place at the First Unitarian Church, 1034 Southwest 13th Avenue in downtown Portland. Thursday, August 1st, doors open at 6:30 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5 p.m. and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio. Up next is the evening news. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University, an institution dedicated to serving adult students by bringing a progressive perspective to educating the whole person. Listeners can learn about 23 bachelor's degree programs in the arts, business, and helping professions at the information session on Saturday, August 24th at 9 a.m. Details can be found online at merrillhurst.edu.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the FBI succeeds in a daring sting operation against U.S. sex trafficking.
Fast food workers in New York City walk out of their restaurants, demanding higher wages and benefits.
Proponents of NSA domestic surveillance receive disproportionate financial support from government contractors. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 29th, 2013. I'm Angelique O'Rourke.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Today was a day of widespread rallies and walkouts by fast food workers in New York City. Members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and city council members were on hand to support the strikers as workers rallied at multiple locations in New York City at noon today. 13 workers walked out of a Fifth Avenue McDonald's location, leaving only managers to operate that franchise. In related news last Friday, workers walked out of a Brooklyn Domino's to protest the firing of an activist coworker following their April strike. Striker Jose Cruz told the online news site Salon that 90% of the workers scheduled for that evening's shift joined the work stoppage, forcing cancellation of deliveries. Workers at two other Domino's locations, as well as Papa John's and McDonald's, also took part in last Friday's action. The first time fast food workers at multiple restaurants across the city ever went on strike was also in New York City last November. After a second one-day strike in New York, workers from other cities followed suit. In coming days, workers in Chicago, St. Louis, Detroit, Milwaukee, Kansas City, and Flint, Michigan will also strike. That's according to a report on the Daily KOS website.
In Portland over the weekend, two teens were rescued and four pimps arrested as part of a nationwide sex trafficking sting. According to FBI spokesman Beth Ann Steele of the Portland office, authorities additionally picked up 13 adult women who will likely face prostitution charges. Over 100 teenagers involved in sex trafficking and exploitation were rescued during the coordinated raids in 76 cities throughout the weekend, the FBI said Monday. The raids resulted in the arrest of 150 pimps involved in the commercial exploitation of both adults and children, said Ronald Hosko, assistant director of the FBI's Criminal Investigative Division. It was the FBI's largest action to date, focusing on the recovery of sexually exploited children, with the youngest child rescued only 13 years of age.
Fire crews battled five new fires in Oregon, covering 10,000 acres, which started over the weekend. Low rainfall levels has officials bracing for more wildfire outbreaks in the region. A wildfire near Goldendale, Washington, grew to approximately 17,000 acres and took more than 1,100 firefighters to contain it. In southern Oregon, 75 residents in Douglas County were told to leave while firefighters combat wildfires sparked by lightning. In other regional wildfire news, nine new fires have broken out in Washington State, encompassing 9,000 acres.
TriMet is planning to retire century-old paper tickets and passes. The TriMet Board of Directors voted unanimously last Wednesday to begin development of a $30 million e-fare system. TriMet's proposed reloadable tap card could allow riders to pay for a fare with a single wave of their bank-issued cards or smartphones over the new readers. In Puget Sound, transit agencies began developing their debit card system 10 years ago. Before boarding a bus, ferry, or train in the Puget Sound region, about 80% of transit riders swipe a card across a digital reader mounted at stations or on vehicles. Unlike the Puget Sound system, which stores encoded information on a card's microchip, TriMet would use an account-based technology that will access data wirelessly from a secure computer server almost instantly. The cards are embedded with integrated circuits that communicate with a terminal via radio waves. The proposed fare system will allow riders to instantly deposit and withdraw funds for tickets. It will also incorporate an incentive program that would work like a frequent rider punch card. The TriMet board approved a $2.4 million contract last week with CH2M Hill, which will design and implement the system over 3 years.
The judge who will decide the fate of Private First Class Bradley Manning, who was accused in the largest leak of classified information in U.S. history, has reached a verdict. Scheduled to be announced on Tuesday, according to military officials, the judge, Army Colonel Denise Lind, will announce her verdict in the so-called WikiLeaks trial in a courtroom at Fort Meade, Maryland at 1 p.m. Manning, who was charged with 21 counts in connection with the leak of some 700,000 classified documents to the WikiLeaks website. The most serious of those charges is aiding the enemy, which could carry a life sentence. The prosecution chose not to pursue capital punishment, which was also an option. Some of the classified documents leaked by Manning ended up in the hands of Osama bin Laden and were recovered in the raid on his compound by U.S. Navy SEALs in Abbottabad, Pakistan. Prosecutors have argued that Manning is a traitor, while his lawyers have characterized him as a naive whistleblower who did not know the material he leaked would end up in the hands of terrorists. In closing arguments in Manning's court-martial Friday, his lawyer, David Combs, said that Manning was a well-intentioned young man who was attempting to, quote, save lives. In a rebuttal, Major Ashton Fain, arguing for the Army, said Manning knew exactly what he was doing and quoted that his actions represented general evil intent. Lynn's stated her deliberations on Friday after nearly 2 months of evidence about testimony about the 25-year-old intelligence analyst. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange said Friday that if Manning is convicted of aiding the enemy, it will be the end of national security journalism in the United States.
The U.S. House of Representatives voted down an amendment last week to defund the National Security Agency's secret phone surveillance program. This amendment was to the $600 billion defense spending bill and would have banned the NSA's indiscriminate collection of domestic phone records. For more, KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with Mark Jaycox of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
The Bush Area Patriot Act gave the National Security Agency, or NSA, the authority to collect phone records relevant to national security. The problem, though, is that according to documents recently leaked by Edward Snowden, the definition of relevant has expanded to include everything, everyone, and every call. Here's Mark Jaycox of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I start by asking him about the NSA program, which prompted the reform effort.
Right now, the government is abusing Section 215 of the Patriot Act, and the Patriot Act was originally crafted to collect the business records and other types of records in regards to investigating national security investigations. And right now, what the leaks have revealed over the past month is that they've been, they've been misinterpreting the statute to include the calling information of all Americans. The statute allows for relevant, quote-unquote, relevant records or any tangible thing that is relevant to an investigation. And the government has argued in a secret court called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that what is relevant to an authorization, to an investigation, are all of these call records of every American.
That might seem to some to be going too far.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, it strikes at one of the core reasons why the Fourth Amendment was created in the first place. The British were using very vague, broad warrants to collect and seize Americans' information. And so, you know, it's a really direct analog. And it certainly goes way too far. It goes further than the statute that was envisioned, which is the Patriot Act, and it goes further, really, than the Fourth Amendment allows.
There was so-called bipartisan support for doing something about it.
So there has been legislation proposed by both houses of Congress, but this was the first piece of legislation. It was an amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill, so the budget for the Defense Department. Congressmen are allowed to add amendments to it, barring certain actions or barring the use of the money. And so the Amash Amendment, it was a bipartisan amendment co-sponsored by Representative Amash and Representative Conyers across the board, Republican and Democrats. And what it did is it would have stopped the information being collected under Section 215, and it would have stopped one aspect of the programs that we've learned about.
Is there a chance to see this in open court?
There's a secret court that oversees the spying, and as I said, it's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And right now, there are secret legal documents and legal opinions that supposedly justify the government's use of Section 215 of the Patriot Act and other surveillance laws. And what's happening right now is, along with the bills to stop the spying and to stop abusing the Section 215 of the Patriot Act, is to reveal these documents and to make sure that the American public can see and these legal arguments, because even the one of the authors of the Patriot Act, Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, has come out saying there's no way that Congress intended the government to the executive to use the Section 215 of the Patriot Act in this manner. And so a lot of civil liberties advocates and a lot of transparency advocates are pushing for these opinions to be released, both in bills and via public pressure, so that the American public can learn how the government justifies these actions, because they strike at the very core of the Constitution, and really a lot of people believe, and you know, we certainly believe, that it's a misinterpretation and abuse of the law.
And can you see how the vote broke down last week?
What happened last week is you saw wide bipartisan support for a very blunt instrument to stop the spying, and that was essentially a clear defunding of any use. Pretty much any use of funds couldn't be used for the collection of Americans' information under Section 215. And you saw a wide variety of people come together from the right and the left to stop this spying. Unfortunately, a lot of the leaders in Congress, like Speaker Pelosi, didn't vote for the amendment, which would have limited the spying. And it's a kind of an interesting issue, because you see a lot of the new members of Congress, as well as these liberal lions like Representative Conyers, come out for the amendment and against the spying. It's a pretty clear example that privacy doesn't have a party. Core constitutional, the Bill of Rights and kind of core constitutional notions about privacy, especially with privacy and modern technology, and the information that can be collected is protected and shouldn't be collected by the government.
This is Congress's first chance to vote since the Snowden revelations. Is this in a way a sanctification of the NSA spying program?
So this is one of the first votes that we've had on the record, and it's certainly a reassuring sign. I mean, what it does is it makes Congress express a clear opinion on the matter, but also provides a stepping stone. Because last year and a couple of years ago, when these statutes were reauthorized, you saw them reauthorized in an overwhelming manner. And to get 205 votes and almost have the amendment pass is a huge step forward. And what it does is it provides a great step to build upon, a great foundation to build upon. Because if this is the way that Congress, that the House is voting for the Amash Amendment, then it's a clear sign that nuanced legislation that stops the spying and ensures privacy protections hopefully will pass.
And what can our listeners here in Portland, Oregon do?
Well, right now there are multiple campaigns going on. I don't know if people have heard, there's a stopwatching.us, called the Stop Watching Us campaign, and it's pushing for legislative reform. It's pushing for more investigations in around the secret law and these programs. And really the biggest thing that individuals can do is to keep on calling their representatives, keep on signing the petition and spreading the word. Because if one thing is certain, and if one thing is for sure, it's that the more people find out about how the government is using these statutes and what the government thinks it can do and it can collect, the more people get angry and the more people get upset. And that is probably the really the best tool, contacting your congressman and just learning about how the government is using these statutes. Because once people learn how they're using it, they certainly agree with the civil liberties community and think that the government is abusing their the statutes and their prerogative.
Great. Well, Mark Jacox, thanks so much for talking to KBOO.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
That was Mark Jacox of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Although the amendment to rein in the NSA's indiscriminate spying failed by a 205 to 217 vote, Mr. Jacox is encouraged by the broad support and is confident that compromise reform is forthcoming. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio news after this newscast, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6, a program dedicated to educating the public about our criminal justice system. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be warmer than today's, with morning clouds and temperatures around 80 degrees. Lows tonight are forecast to be around 58 degrees.
It's 5:16. It's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Stop the moochers, shouted a flock of GOP budget whackers in the U.S. House recently as they literally ripped all food stamp funding out of the farm bill. They say they are shocked that use of this program has jumped so dramatically in recent years, crying that those people are costing us money. The House whacked the entire budget for getting food to the poor. Well, yes, food stamp use is up, but hello, clueless Congress critters. So is the need. Long-term joblessness and falling wages are sucking more and more of your constituents out of the middle class down into the vortex of poverty. It's disgraceful for you well-paid lawmakers to gut a poverty program that's working exactly as it's meant to do, at the very time it's most needed. But next, the flock of budget whackers suddenly flew completely off course. Going from disgraceful to disgusting, they approved a farm bill that gives ridiculous taxpayer handouts to the biggest and richest agribusiness operations in our land. Those entities are wallowing in record-high crop prices and farm income this year, yet the GOP's pious deficit skulls turned into free-spending corporate socialists, doling out the most generous farm subsidies in U.S. history. For example, they perverted the crop insurance program into an absurd guaranteed income plan for the wealthiest farms, each of which will collect more than $1 million a year from us. Moreover, these free market Republicans would also have the government, i.e. you and me, guarantee an artificially high price for various commodities produced by the giant farms. And they would make all of these subsidies permanent. This is Jim Hightower saying, no grocery money for the needy, but a free feed for millionaire farmers? That's a moral abomination. For more information and action, contact the Environmental Working Group, www.ewg.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
111 Democrats and 94 Republicans voted last week to continue funding of domestic telephone surveillance by the National Security Agency. A new report examining congressional backers of the NSA programs reveals possible influence from government contractors. MapLight, a political research organization based in Berkeley, California, found that legislators voting to preserve the NSA budget received more than twice the campaign donations as those who voted in favor of stripping the agency's finances. Their Vice President of Communications, Pamela Bearson, spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan about the organization's charter and elected officials from Oregon Voted.
surprising about which elected officials voted for and or against this bill?
Well, it wasn't a partisan vote. That was one of the most interesting things. We're not saying that the money caused the vote, but we do think that money biases our political system.
Is the question one of tenure?
Yes, it seems to be that way. Nancy Pelosi voted no, and many of her fellow Democrats voted yes on this. I think it's quite refreshing to see a nonpartisan vote in Congress. And it definitely has struck a nerve in a lot of members of the House, and there was testimony that transpired during the amendment for it was a defense spending bill. And I think a lot of people weren't sure how they were going to vote, and they may have had an idea, and they changed their mind.
Can you tell me about the formula that you used and were able to determine that those voting to keep these programs funded have received 122% more money than the opposition?
Yeah, so what we did is we took a look at the defense industry money on this one, the money that they've given to the House over the past election cycle. So that would be January 1, 2011 to December 31st, 2012. And we found that on average, the defense industry gave about $41,000 to legislators that voted no, and the amendment would have blocked funding for NSA surveillance activities that are not limited to specific persons of interest. It's more, what's going on now is more of a dragnet approach. The House members that voted no on this, that would continue this type of strategy that the NSA is using. And those who voted yes to stop this type of surveillance received on average $18,000, so considerably less.
What do you see as likely next steps in the battle for the restoration of the Fourth Amendment? What's it going to take? How do we get politics to be about genuine and substantive governance rather than pay to play?
I think a lot of people are asking that question. And, you know, in a post-Citizens United world, it's becoming clear that money dominates our political system and drowns out the voice of the public.
I did do a quick courtesy check on this particular bill with regard to the Oregon congressional delegation in the second district, I believe it is, Greg Walden. The only pro-NSA vote, you wouldn't happen to have offhand how much money he received from the defense industry, would you?
He has received $37,500 from the defense industry.
For the most recent election cycle?
Yes, the 2012 election cycle, which includes 2011 and 2012.
That was KBOO's Robin Ryan speaking with the Vice President of Communications for MapLight, Pamela Bearson.
In the latest news from U.S. occupied Afghanistan and surrounding territories, more than a dozen car bombs ripped through marketplaces, parking lots, and rush hour crowds in Iraq today, killing at least 55 people and pushing the country's death toll for the month of July toward the 700 mark, officials said. Afghan authorities say 14 people have died in two separate bombings in southern Afghanistan. The first bombing occurred in Zabul province late on July 26, killing 11 and wounding 20 people. Local officials say the dead included a senior police official, two local policemen, and eight civilians. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack. Two suicide blasts in a crowded market in western Pakistan on Friday killed at least 40 people and injured at least 100 in an apparent sectarian attack, residents said, presenting a fresh challenge to the administration of newly elected Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. On July 27th, at least 45 Taliban militants were killed following an airstrike by NATO-led International Coalition Security Forces in southern Helmand province of Afghanistan. According to a statement released by Helmand Provincial Government Media Department, the militants were killed in Deshu and Khan Shin districts of Helmand province.
And now we go to the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, July 29, 2013. Israeli soldiers kidnap 6 civilians in morning invasions targeting West Bank communities, and settlers attack farmers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Monday at dawn 6 Palestinian civilians during invasions targeting the southern West Bank district of Hebron. Local sources said that troops invaded Al-Arub refugee camp near Hebron and clashed with local youth, then kidnapped 3 teenagers aged 14 years old. In Beit Umar town nearby, soldiers searched and ransacked homes, then kidnapped one man. Later, troops invaded the old city part of Hebron, searched homes and kidnapped 2 teenagers as well. Elsewhere in northern West Bank, Israeli settlers attacked Palestinian farmers near the village of Sannur and also attacked Palestinian cars driving at the Nablus-Jenin road. Local sources announced that the settlers came back to the evacuated settlement of Tarsala and conducted their attacks from there. The settlement of Tarsala was evacuated in 2005 and settlers are attempting to go back to it ever since. According to the international law, all Israeli settlements in the West Bank are illegal and should be removed. In other news, a bus loaded of family members of political detainees from the Gaza Strip was allowed by the Israeli army to leave the coastal region to visit their family members held by the Israeli army. According to the Red Cross Society, this visit is the first visit since 6 years, and it's part of a deal reached between the Palestinian detainees and the Israeli army last year after a hunger strike protest the prisoners did. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, July 29th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Seamus Sloan-White and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, John Rasmussen, and Joe Meyer. The producer is Ross Freeman-Levin. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. And the KBOO Evening News Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews.
If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM. And K220HR Hood River, 90.9 FM. I'm Angelique O'Rourke.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, hear the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. At 9, an alternative radio author and activist Sandra Stengarber speaks on fracking and public health. And at 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary.
At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio presents a documentary special on Portland urban naturalist Mike Houck, produced by Humankind Media. At 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Galavan interviews photographer Holly Andres about her show, The Homecoming, and about shooting the Sasquatch Festival for Teen Vogue, and her love of Instagram.
Thank you to the KABU members for your generous support for this community radio station. If you're not yet a KABU member, you can become one by going to KABU.fm, that's KBOO.fm, and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the Worker-Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, John.
Good night, Angelique.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 29th, 2013. In Boston, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, civil rights leaders meet with President Obama as the Justice Department launches new efforts to protect the right to vote. In Egypt, human rights groups condemn violence against protesters as tense demonstrations continue. And we'll go to Thailand, where a local community fights back against a coal company and wins, but some activists pay with their lives. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm George Lavender with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Talks between Israel and Palestine are set to begin in Washington, D.C. Monday night. This comes as Israel has agreed to release more than 100 Palestinian political prisoners, a key demand of the Palestinian Authority. Yet some in both Israel and Palestine remain sceptical, as hundreds protested the return to negotiations. FSRN's Ghassan Banoura reports from Bethlehem.
10 people were arrested and dozens injured by Palestinian police in Ramallah on Sunday during a protest against renewed negotiations between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. Negotiators from the two sides are scheduled to meet in Washington, D.C. today to discuss the basis for future peace talks. The meetings follow recent diplomatic efforts by Secretary of State John Kerry. On Sunday, demonstrators attempted to reach the offices of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, but were met with violence from the police who blocked their way. Some of the injured were arrested at the hospital. Among the protesters was Palestinian lawmaker Khalida Jarrar.
We refuse to go back to the framework of direct bilateral negotiations under American supervision because we tried such negotiations for 20 years and it only led us to the situation we're in today, which is changing facts on the ground, expansion of settlement construction, and continued occupation.
Khalida and many other Palestinian politicians say that since Israel is not willing to remove settlements on Palestinian land occupied since 1967 and refuses to discuss the status of Jerusalem and Palestinian refugees, the talks are doomed to fail. Ghassan Banoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
Fast food workers across the U.S. are walking off the job today in a one-day strike. Workers say they want a minimum wage of $15 an hour. Protests are occurring in Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Louis, and Kansas City. In Brooklyn, FSRN's Rebecca Miles has more.
From Fulton Street to Union Square to Flatbush Avenue in New York today, fast food workers at Burger King, KFC, McDonald's and Wendy's walked off the job in a one-day strike protesting low wages and demanding the right to form a union. According to organizers, Fast Food Forward, workers earn as little as $7.25 an hour, and they say workers often do shift work so employers don't have to offer benefits. New York State is set to increase minimum wage from $7.25 to $9 by 2016, but organizers here and around the country say that's still not enough. Rebecca Miles, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
In California, hundreds of prisoners are beginning the fourth week of a hunger strike to protest long-term solitary confinement. Prison officials say that so far, 42 people have sought treatment in prison infirmaries for medical issues related to the strike. Officials also confirmed that a prisoner in solitary confinement at Corcoran State Prison in Central California died last Monday. Details of his death only began to emerge over the weekend. Prisoners and their supporters say that the 32-year-old man had been imprisoned for more than 10 years, including at least 5 years in isolation. Ron Arnon is president of California Prison Focus, a human rights organization, and a member of an 8-person mediation team advocating on behalf of the hunger-striking prisoners.
Prisoners who knew him reported that he participated in this hunger strike. He participated in the 2011 hunger strike, that he was a strong individual but it was really uncharacteristic of him. They were very shocked to hear that he may have committed suicide, and so we're going to be calling for an independent investigation to find out about the circumstances of his death.
In a statement, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation denied that the prisoner had been participating in the hunger strike at the time he died and called the accusation, quote, inflammatory. Activists in Florida are continuing their sit-in at the offices of Republican Governor Rick Scott in Tallahassee. Calling themselves Dream Defenders, the group began their protest after the trial of George Zimmerman ended 2 weeks ago. A jury found Zimmerman not guilty of murdering teenager Trayvon Martin. Activists with the Dream Defenders have met with Governor Scott and asked him to call a special session of the legislature, but say they are disappointed with the response so far. Ahmad Abuznaid is the legal and policy director for the Dream Defenders. He says that after 2 weeks, there are no plans to end the sit-in.
We're willing to continue to fight and continue to protest until the governor and our leaders here call for a special legislative session, which is what we need. We need a special legislative session to deal with issues such as standard ground law, racial profiling, and the school-to-prison pipeline.
Abuznaid says that the activists have been told they can stay as long as they want. Up to 100 people have been sitting in at any one time, with supporters traveling from across the country to take part. And those are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Oakland, California, I'm George Lavender.
I'm Dorian Marina in Boston. Civil rights leaders and the Attorney General met with President Obama at the White House today to discuss how to prevent voter suppression in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision striking down a key section of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. The Justice Department announced last week that it will ask a federal court to force Texas to seek federal approval for any changes in voting laws and may pursue action in other states. But both officials and voting rights advocates say the Justice Department's enforcement powers will remain weak until Congress drafts and passes a new Voting Rights Act. In Washington, D.C., FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
President Obama spoke Monday with the American Civil Liberties Union, the NAACP, and other civil rights organizations about the future of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The government's ability to enforce that law was drastically altered in June when the Supreme Court struck down Section 4, which dictated the criteria used to determine if a state or county needs federal permission to change its voting laws. Now, states and counties that have been covered by Section 4 for decades due to their documented record of discrimination will be free to pass voting restrictions until Congress approves new criteria. Speaking before the meeting, White House spokesperson Josh Earnest told reporters that the president will urge lawmakers to quickly do so.
There are some communities in this country where those rights have historically been at risk, and ensuring that there are protections in place to protect those rights is something that has attracted bipartisan support before and deserves bipartisan support in the future.
With Section 4 struck down, the government has two remaining ways to protect these at-risk voters. They can sue states that pass discriminatory laws after those laws take effect, using Section 2, or they can ask a federal court to designate a specific area as needing federal oversight, using Section 3. Attorney General Eric Holder did so with Texas on Thursday, saying current evidence of intentional racial discrimination in that state, as well as a, quote, history of pervasive voting-related discrimination against racial minorities, justified federal scrutiny of its voting laws. Attorney General Holder promised the Justice Department will take further action in the months ahead, but said only Congress can fill the current void in voting rights enforcement. Counsel Natasha Korganker with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund agreed. As her organization's director met with the president at the White House, she told FSRN that passing a new Section 4 is the only way to stop the current assault on voting rights.
Since June and the loss of Section 4, we have seen a number of states passing a lot of really radical voting changes.
The governor of North Carolina is set to sign a bill this week that will roll back early voting hours, implement a strict voter ID requirement, and end same-day voter registration. Without a fully functional Voting Rights Act, Kirgonker said it's more vital than ever for voters to be their own government watchdogs and report any attempts of voter suppression to the Justice Department. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
In Egypt, supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi continued protests today, targeting government and military buildings in Cairo, despite violent crackdowns by security forces working with the recently installed interim president. Over the weekend, security forces killed more than 75 protesters in clashes in Cairo. That violence followed mass demonstrations last Friday in support of the military. For more, we're joined by Tamara Al-Rafai, spokesperson with Human Rights Watch. Welcome to FSRN.
Yes, hi. Thank you for inviting us.
You interviewed eyewitnesses and reviewed tape from the clashes that took place last Saturday at the Muslim Brotherhood sit-in in eastern Cairo. Protesters were shot and killed over a period of at least 6 hours. Who are the victims?
Unfortunately, the victims are mostly protesters, mostly people who are demonstrating on the streets of Egypt their support, either for ousted President Morsi, but also people opposing them, people supporting the interim government and people supporting the military. The situation has turned violent, and many people lost their lives when they are only supposed to be expressing their political views. The ones that Human Rights Watch documented this last weekend, were mostly pro-Morsi, so people who are demonstrating in support of the ousted Egyptian president. Unfortunately, Human Rights Watch was able to talk to their families, but also to witnesses who were on location and who were able to give live testimonies of how the attacks happened.
And in those attacks, eyewitnesses did tell you that protesters threw rocks and tear gas canisters at the police. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. Eyewitnesses did say that there was violence instigated by protesters that had been staging sit-ins in support of the ousted Egyptian president. But then the military and the security forces, the police present on location, used live ammunition and shot dead a number of protesters. And the shots were mostly in the head and in the upper parts of the body, leading us to believe that there were no limits to what the police and security forces were allowed to do in order to just to contain these protests.
In fact, in your report, or at least what medical experts told your reporters, is that some of the wounds appear to show that some of the victims were targeted, that these could be targeted killings.
Yes, it could be, because it's difficult to imagine that so much death has happened without the intention to kill. And as a reminder, Human Rights Watch had already documented excessive use of force and targeted killing of protesters early on in the Egyptian uprising over 2 years ago. So this is not a new type of practice by the Egyptian security forces. This is a practice that has been used before. It has been used in early 2011, which is when the protests that led to the removal of then President Hosni Mubarak from power.
Military leaders have said that security forces did not point arms at protesters. Is there evidence to support this claim?
It's difficult for the military to make these claims when our own team, a Human Rights Watch team, but also the medical personnel, the doctors in the hospitals that are receiving the wounded and the dead, see clear signs of bullets in the heads and in the chest of people who are demonstrating.
Now, pro-Morsi protesters have called for even larger protests this evening and tomorrow. In a statement, the Anti-Coup Alliance of Islamist Groups urged Egyptians to go out into the streets and squares to, quote, regain their freedom and dignity. What can be done to ensure safe protests from all sides in this conflict?
It's really worth noting that the Egyptian society today is very strongly divided. It's really polarized. We can speak of a huge portion of the society in support of change, in support of the interim government and the military, but also a very big portion of the society still backing the Muslim Brotherhood and still calling for the release of Mohamed Morsi and for his return to power as a president. Now, Egypt is not the only country in the world where such mass protests happen. Mass protests happen elsewhere, and there are international standards for the police to deal with protesters on the street. There are ways to cordon certain areas off. There are ways to negotiate with protesters. There are ways of doing things that do not need that would not necessarily lead to that high number of deaths.
Tamara Al-Rifai is with Human Rights Watch. The group has been monitoring security forces and their response to protests in Egypt. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome, and thanks for inviting us on the show.
In Thailand, a court has ordered the closure of a coal company's operations in a province near the capital city of Bangkok following local protests over pollution. But it's a bittersweet victory for local activists. One of the protest leaders was killed during the long campaign against the coal plant. Human rights advocates in the country say it's just one of a rising number of killings and disappearances that authorities are failing to investigate and stop. From Bangkok, FSRN's Ron Corbin reports.
Thongnut Sewak Chinda was shot and killed outside his home in July 2011. Thongnut's killing came days after he led a protest exposing the illegal transport of coal through the province. Environmental lawyer Srisawan Janya knew Thongnut and had put his support behind the community's campaign.
The saddest thing that I feel is that I am not able to use my profession to protect people's lives.
Thongnut's death was one of more than 20 activists who have paid with their lives over the past 12 years during campaigns over the environment and land. In Thailand's southern Surathani province, Monta Chakau and Prani Bunrat, both women in their 50s, were heading to the local morning market on their motorcycles in mid-November last year when they were gunned down. Both Monta and Prani were members of the Southern Peasants Federation, set up in 2008 to fight for land rights in an area controlled by a palm oil company. Somchai Homlo